Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 160, recorded Saturday, February 29th, 2020. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this special leap year procrastination edition of the Travel Commons Podcast. Seat back screens fading away, and any difference left between rideshare and taxis? Coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, I finished my Phoenix travels at the end of January and made the last trip a bleisure trip, business and leisure. Business in Phoenix Monday through Thursday afternoon, and then leisure Thursday night through Sunday with a ski weekend in Durango, Colorado. First time actually I've been on the slopes in 7 years. And I got to tell you, my legs felt it. I had first thought about heading up to Salt Lake for the weekend and skiing there. But when I saw that the Sundance Film Festival was the same weekend, I thought to myself, yeah, no. And then started Googling for other ideas. The ski slopes around Flagstaff, Arizona, so, you know, what was that, maybe 3-hour drive north of Phoenix, they were just too small. But on the other hand, around Denver, I didn't want to have to fight the traffic on I-70 Sunday afternoon going back to the airport. Durango, which is in the San Juan Mountains, kind of in the southwest corner of Colorado near Four Corners, looked like a good spot. I mean, it's a quick and fairly inexpensive hour flight from Phoenix. It's an actual town, not just a ski resort. So there'd be other things to do when the lifts closed. The lift tickets at Purgatory and also Wolf Creek ski area close by were reasonable, sort of 40 to 50% of the price of, say, Vail or Park City lift ticket. I was able to book a whole tiny house on Airbnb for the price of a generic Fairfield Inn room. And, well, I've never been to Durango before. And as I found out from my Airbnb host after I'd booked everything, it was the weekend of Durango's Snowdown Festival, the 42nd annual, with a parade down Main Street and everything. The snow was just okay, but the skiing was great. Beautiful weather, damn short lift lines, and really nice people. Kind of a weird but fun combination of families, mostly from Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, and the whole Colorado hippy-dippy ski bum crew. It was just a nice ending to my 2 months in Phoenix. The only downside was I had to check a bag. Even though I had rented all my equipment, skis, boots, poles, I still needed that extra bag for all the other paraphernalia. Helmet, ski pants, gloves, parka. I mean, I love skiing, but it requires a lot of stuff. Not that it costs me anything. I mean, checking the bag, that is. Even flying basic economy on American from Phoenix to Durango, I got free bags with my platinum status. Though American's website wasn't very clear about that when they tried to upsell me off of basic economy. Imagine that. And while I got free bags, I couldn't select my seat in advance. But given that it was a small regional jet with no middle seats, I figured I'd risk it. I will say, though, that I was pretty happy with the teal green luggage tags that I had bought before the trip. Made it very easy to spot my bags amidst, you know, the sea of black suitcases on the luggage belt. Probably the best $5 I've spent in Amazon for a while. One detail I missed when planning my ski weekend is that my Sunday night flights from Durango to Denver to Chicago would be right in the middle of the Super Bowl. Though I'm not really sure I'd have changed anything if I'd actually remembered it. I really didn't have a dog in that hunt. I'm not a big San Francisco or Kansas City fan. And so, kind of like everyone else who isn't in the Bay Area, I was rooting more for Andy Reid than Kansas City. I did end up catching most of the game, but it was a little choppy. I watched the kickoff and the first quarter in the bar at Durango Airport. Now, Durango Airport isn't big, just 4 gates, if I remember correctly, and the bar kind of sticks out into the gate seating area. So I sat at the bar, had a beer, watched the game on the TV hanging on the wall near gate 2, or I don't know, maybe gate 3. But then United called boarding, so I caught bits of the second quarter on the Fox TV iPhone app while waiting for the plane to take off for Denver. And then I tracked the start of the third quarter after touchdown at DIA and what was a really long taxi. I caught the rest of the third quarter on multiple screens, bars, CNN gate TVs, while walking down the B concourse to make my O'Hare connection. I got lucky, though, and was able to catch all of Kansas City's really phenomenal comeback uninterrupted in a Mexican restaurant with about a dozen other fixated passengers and restaurant workers. After Kansas City's final interception, I walked down and caught the final plays on the CNN TV at the gate. I have to tell you, every other night, I consciously avoid those CNN TVs. The volumes are always up, and people are always yelling at each other. But this night, I was actually happy for that volume, because it was the one night they weren't showing CNN. Following up, the week after that last Phoenix trip, I wrote a post on the Travel Commons website listing my favorite food and beer hangouts in downtown Phoenix. When I started traveling to Phoenix in the mid-90s, it's been that long, there wasn't much to downtown Phoenix other than a big Hyatt Regency hotel. Everything else was in Scottsdale and Tempe. I'd usually stay in Tempe because with Arizona State University there, there were restaurants and bars that I could walk to. Now, fast forward to today, downtown Phoenix has a lot more going on. Stadiums for the Phoenix Suns and the Arizona Diamondbacks and a new downtown campus for ASU's law school bring in enough people to support a really solid selection of restaurants, coffee shops, and bars. The blog post doesn't cover everything, just the places that I found myself going back to again and again over this past 2 months. Now, most of my flights from the mid-90s on that went into Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport went into Terminal 2 on United and on American until American moved to the much better Terminal 4 after merging with US Air, which had merged with American West, the original hub airline for Phoenix. Got that? That's kind of family tree stuff. So Terminal 2, though, was Terminal 2 was Phoenix's slum terminal. And I've talked about this in prior podcasts, how it seems like every airport has its slum terminal for non-hub airlines that everybody else gets crammed into. In O'Hare, actually, it's also Terminal 2. But Phoenix, absolutely Terminal 2. It was built in 1962 and was originally planned to shut down in 2000. But they finally shut it down like a couple of weeks ago, February 4th, 2020, the week after I finished my latest Phoenix gig. The last two airlines using it, United and Alaska Air, have moved to Terminal 3 with the rest of the non-hub carriers. Phoenix's two major carriers, American and Southwest, split Terminal 4. Some of the newspaper articles said business travelers like Terminal 2 because it was compact, easy to navigate. I am not one of those guys. I thought Terminal 2 was a cramped, low-ceilinged place with small restrooms and lousy food and beer options when I had to wait out the inevitable O'Hare delay. I think you can tell that I won't miss Terminal 2. The plans that I read about are to demo the terminal this year and replace it with kind of European-style bus gates, where instead of jetways, you use buses to take passengers out to remotely parked aircraft. I'm going to bet those bus gates are not going to be popular in August when Phoenix Sky Harbor's tarmac temperature hits about 120 degrees. Waiting for my American Eagle Phoenix Durango flight, I was kind of half paying attention to the PA announcements, but then noticed that the gate agent wasn't doing the boarding announcements. Instead, they were using recorded announcements. Now, this isn't kind of what really caught my attention, though. I've heard recorded gate announcements hundreds of times, but usually they're recordings of humans reading the announcements. Here at Gate 19, it was one of those kind of really robotic text-to-speech synthesized voices, something like,
"Now boarding groups 1, 2, and 3.
I mean, why? How much savings do you get by using text-to-speech over having some gate agent standing in a closet and recording it on, say, their iPhone, at worst? I don't know, maybe more than I think now that American has what? I don't know, 7, 10, 123 boarding groups? I asked this question, why the robot, out loud, to Twitter. Now, American actually came back. We heard back, and the Phoenix gate staff actually does record the voices used in the announcements. They are real humans. Now, I have to say kudos for American's Twitter staff for following up. But I tell you, unless the Phoenix gate staff has an Android with a bad vocal box working for them, I think the gang at B19 is using texttospeech.org. I posted an article on the Travel Commons Facebook page about a guy who wore a plastic tent on a plane to avoid coronavirus. Now, as it turns out, it was really more of a publicity stunt for the guy's company. He makes personal tents to protect people from bad weather when sitting on the sidelines of their kids' soccer games. I don't know, it might cut down on colds that I catch when flying, but from the picture, it looks like it would be quite a pain to move, or for me to move, out of my aisle seat when the guy in the window seat wants to get out and use the toilet. On January 6th, the first Monday of the new year, and actually the first time I was in O'Hare in the new year in 2020, I posted a picture on Twitter of the cannabis amnesty box that was on the other side of security at O'Hare's Terminal 1. Pot became legal in Illinois the first of the year, and the Chicago Department of Aviation put out these boxes, in their words, so travelers have the opportunity to ensure compliance with federal law as well as the local laws at their destination. If you look at the picture I posted, the box looks like something the maintenance guys kind of knocked together in the wood shop during their break. So no surprise that 3 weeks later, somebody broke into a similar box at Midway Airport and helped themselves to some surrendered weed. Actually, I think the only surprise is that it took as long as 3 weeks for this to happen.
And if you have any travel stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along.
Text or audio comment to comments at travelcommons.com.
You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or our Instagram account at Travel Commons.
Or you can always go old school and post your comments on the website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is seatback screens fading away. On my flight from Durango to Denver, half the guys on the plane were staring down at their phones during boarding and taxi, watching the second quarter of the Super Bowl until the plane rotated up off the runway. For folks flying United planes with DirecTV seatback screens, those repainted Continental 737s, no problems. Just swipe your credit card and keep watching. But that's a shrinking group. Seatback entertainment screens have been on the death watch list for, I think, 5 years now. But they finally seem to be on their way out, at least on a lot of domestic routes. And I can't say that I really miss them. I mean, the DirecTV controls on those United planes are in the armrest, so I'm always changing the channel or the volume or the screen brightness whenever I put my arms down. On American 737s, those screens are just bulging out of the back seat into what is already a tight, tight space, thanks to American's war on seat pitch. I tell you, when I'm on one of those planes, I have to recline my seat just to be able to get, just to be able to focus on what's on that screen. And the power supplies for all those seatback units are under the seat, so they end up crowding out whatever little bit of space I've got for, say, a briefcase and my feet. I have to tell you, I'm happy with BYOS, bring your own screen. I actually, on a recent flight, I watched the season finale of the Mandalorian Star Wars TV show on my 8-inch Samsung tablet. Now, it wasn't as good as watching it on, say, my 65-inch LG, 4K TV that I've got at home, but this Samsung tablet was bigger than any domestic in-flight screen. On one of my Southwest flights home from Phoenix, I actually saw a guy hang his big iPhone Max, the supersized iPhone. He was kind of hanging it from the tray on the seat back in front of him, kind of a DIY seatback entertainment unit. Now, my opinion changes a little bit on long international flights. I can see the case for seatback screens. I mean, if you're on a flight for 8 hours, 11 hours, 14 hours, say if you're going over to China or going over to India, that's a long time to be kind of staring down. You like to be able to sort of look straight ahead. Also, my wife and kids have kind of perfected synchronized movie viewing on international flights. They're sitting three abreast, they queue up the same movie and then count down. 3, 2, 1, press play. And it's kind of the airplane version of watching a movie together in the living room. Now, I'm not sure that it would be the same if they were all looking down on their iPhones. And this tends to work better on newer planes like the 787 that have got bigger screens. I remember Andrew trying to watch the movie Dunkirk, which, if you guys remember, was this big World War II action movie that was great on IMAX, and that's how I saw it. Andrew's trying to watch it on what is maybe a 7-inch seatback screen on a United 767. Somehow, I just don't think he got the full experience of that movie. Back in December, United tweeted out their top 10 most watched in-flight movies in 2019. Bohemian Rhapsody, A Star is Born, and Crazy Rich Asians were 1, 2, 3. Makes sense. In ninth place, though, was John Wick 3, which is the third installment of the Keanu Reeves kind of Fist of Fury action flick. I loved that movie, but I got to tell you, I can't see even the new 16-inch screens in United's business class being big enough to handle that flick. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is, any difference left between rideshare and taxis? I got an email survey the other day asking for my thoughts, impressions about Uber and Lyft. One of the questions was how long I'd used each of them. Less than a year, 1 to 2 years, 2 to 3 years, more than 3 years, which kind of got me wondering. So I pulled out my iPhone, fired up each of the apps. My first Uber ride was in December 2013 from Midtown Manhattan to LaGuardia at 4 p.m. on a Tuesday. I signed up. I remember this. I signed up because it is such a pain to find a regular cab to take you to LaGuardia at rush hour. And I remember this. I'd forgotten to book a ride with the black car service that I would normally use. Interesting that I didn't use Uber again for another 6 months in June 2014, when again, I didn't have a black car booked for a ride from Philadelphia Airport to a client out in the suburbs along the Blue Route. I signed up for Lyft in December 2015 when I was in Las Vegas for a project. I had been using Uber more frequently in 2015, but back then only Lyft had permission to drop off at Las Vegas Airport. We'd used Uber, but they'd have to drop us off at the rental car center, and then we'd end up taking a bus to the terminal. I did this exactly one time, and then pivoted to Lyft. So, according to this email survey, which at the end revealed itself actually to be sponsored by Uber, I am a grizzled ride-sharing veteran, as I'm sure many of you are too. And ride-sharing was what it was back then, an app-driven version of the old ride-sharing bulletin boards. I'm driving from Chicago to Rockford looking for somebody to split the gas and tolls, except doing it locally. And I remember at the start, this had caused a bit of an etiquette challenge. I mean, do I sit in the front, because this is not a taxi, it's somebody sharing their ride with me, or do I sit in the back? And you were careful because it was their car, and usually a nice one. Certainly much nicer and way less beat up than the typical cab. And there were usually good stories from the drivers. You know, all but a couple were doing it part-time to make some additional cash. Way back at episode 125 in November 2016, early on in my Uber and Lyft days, in that episode I related some of the best stories that I'd heard. And then a year later, an Uber or Lyft driver, I can't remember which, in Charlottesville, Virginia, told me that he was driving full-time, that was a new one, and wanted to expand. So he bought 3 used Toyota Corollas, even back then the preferred rideshare car, and was renting them out to Hispanics, his words, who were driving Uber and Lyft a couple hours north in Washington, D.C., in the D.C. area. Interesting idea, but like the standard taxi cab model, leasing licensed cabs to drivers for a shift, but without the need to drop money on a taxi license or a medallion in places like New York and Chicago. Interestingly enough, there are now 6 to 7 companies, including Hertz, offering daily and weekly rentals if you don't want to share rides in your own personal car. back in December, landing in Chicago Midway on a Southwest flight from back from Phoenix, I did my usual drill, opened up Uber and Lyft as I got off the plane, checked the prices, the wait times for a ride home. The prices were about the same, but the wait time, 10 minutes for Uber, 2 minutes for Lyft. Lyft it is. I hit the request ride button, but instead of doing the search for a driver, I immediately got a four-digit PIN. So I head downstairs and get into a queue that looks a lot like the cab line a few doors over, except this one is run by women in pink Lyft safety vests. But they're doing pretty much the same thing the cab rank workers do, wave down cars, then point passengers to them. I wait, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes to get into a car, show the guy the PIN on my Lyft app, he enters it into his app, and boom, off we go. A little less hectic than the typical airport rideshare scrum. But again, how is this different than a taxi, except that I don't have to ask the driver if his credit card machine works? Indeed, on most of my trips over the past year, arriving in Phoenix or Charlottesville, there typically wouldn't be a line for a cab, so I'd skip the 5 to 10 minute wait for Uber or Lyft. Or when I was returning from Durango with my extra bag of ski paraphernalia, I skipped the schlep up to the rideshare pickup zone and instead just walked out the door to a waiting cab. And really, the price difference is shrinking. As we talked about on episode 154, Uber and Lyft have been nudging their rates up to stem their losses. And this is not to say that there aren't important differences, places where Uber and Lyft bring real value. Now, I was working in New Orleans before Uber set up shop. It was impossible to get a cab anywhere other than between the airport and the French Quarter. Trying to get to and from, say, a restaurant in Midtown or Uptown was painful until Uber showed up. And so they've really broken that monopoly and brought cab service, really. If we're going to be serious, I mean, they brought cab service to underserved neighborhoods in cities everywhere. It kind of feels, though, like after all the hype, the battles with regulators, the IPOs, that Uber and Lyft have used billions of venture capital dollars to break the medallion monopolies and build really some phenomenal taxi dispatch systems. As a traveler, it's been great for me. For the investors, though, well, I got to tell you, I'm glad I skipped those IPOs. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons Podcast 160. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa, iTunes, and Spotify. The links along with the RSS feeds are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that, in the social media section, are links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. If you're already subscribed, please think about leaving us a review on one of these sites somewhere. And if you've got, as always, a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to M. Peacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Travel Commons Instagram site, or how many ors can I get in here? Post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. And until next month when we talk again, travel safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.